Welcome to another episode of the Genetically Speaking podcast. I'm your host, Eli Robertson. Today, I'm talking to Claudia Gonzaga Jauregui. Thanks for listening. Claudia, could you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Sure. Hi, Eli. I am Claudia Gonzaga Jauregui. I'm an assistant professor at the International Laboratory for Human Genome Research of UNAM, the National Autonomous University in Mexico. I do research in human genetics and genomics, mostly focusing on Mendelian disorders and genomic rearrangements that lead to genetic disorders. But I'm also very passionate about genomic equity, especially in Latin American countries and other low and middle income countries where this genomics revolution has not reached as much yet as we would like.
To start us off, can you tell us why you were interested in science and about your career journey from where you started to where you are now?
Sure, very briefly. I always like sort of animals and living things and like anatomy and things like that. So I used to play being doctor as a kid. But then I think more specifically, when I was in high school, it was the time of the Human Genome Project. I think that's definitely one of the things that influenced a lot of my interest in science and especially genetics and genomics. So all the fuss about like the impact of the human genome and being able to sequence a whole human genome and that was all happening when I was in high school. And then I also participated in some science Olympiads as a high school student. So that was also a way to get closer to what the scientific career could be. My family is mostly lawyers, so I didn't have really any family members that were in science. So I said I'm a de novo mutation there in my family for the interest in science. I participated in the biology Olympiad and I did well. So that kind of sparked an interest in like, well, I really like this and I seem to be kind of good at this. So maybe this is an option as a career. And I was always interested in health. So eventually combining those two things, I thought of going into biology and doing eventually a PhD in human genetics. And then when I was in my last year of high school, the university at UNAM in Mexico, they opened the genomic sciences undergraduate program, which was one of the very few undergraduate programs in genomics at that time. And that was basically everything that I was interested on: molecular biology, genetics. I had had some exposure to a little bit of programming in high school, but this was very heavy programming and mathematics and modeling and that. So that was also interesting to me. So I did my undergrad in genomic sciences. And then after I graduated, again, I always had the interest in human genetics and diseases. Unfortunately, at that time, there wasn't a lot of human genomics happening in Mexico, so the option was going out. So I applied to graduate school and I was accepted at Baylor, which was wonderful. Baylor has one of the best genetics departments in the U.S. and probably the world. And then it has a Human Genome Sequencing Center. So I was also there at the time where we were just exploring the utility of human genomic sequencing beyond sort of the Human Genome Project, but for actual applications. So at the time, most of the genomes that had been sequenced were like from famous old white dudes. And it was a question, right? Like, is the Human Genome Project really going to deliver on benefits for health and for people? Or it's just going to be a technology of commodity, right? Only the famous and the rich will be able to pay for that because it was still pretty expensive at the time. So we did one of the first proof of concept studies to show that doing whole genome sequencing, you could identify the cause of a genetic disease. So we did that study with sequencing the genome of my PhD advisor, Jim Lobsky. And I remember Jim calling me to his office and saying, you know, we're doing this sequencing and you know to do that stuff with the bioinformatics. So why don't you analyze my genome? And of course, as a first year graduate student that had done genomics, like having the data for a whole human genome was like a huge gift for me at the time. So I was very excited. So I did the analysis. At that time, there were no tools, very few annotations. So I came up with my own annotation pipeline to analyze this data. And eventually we found the variants for Jim and we published that. So, and that sort of kickstarted a lot of the implementation of genomics for medical genetics and identifying disease genes and diagnosing rare diseases as we see it now. So that was very exciting. Then I did a postdoc and then I went into industry. I never really thought of going into industry, but I had a not particularly good experience as a postdoc. So there was this kind of fork in the path of either leaving science completely or maybe trying something else. And then I went into trying industry and I was at a pharmaceutical company for 7 years, analysis of sequencing projects for all sorts of genetic diseases. And then in 2020, 2021, I moved back to Mexico. I physically moved back in 2021 to start my research group at UNAM, working on genomics of Mendelian diseases here. Primarily because there, due to a motivation that there is not a lot of genomics happening for patients that live with rare diseases in Latin America. Of course, this is also happening in other low and middle income countries, but I was doing large scale analysis of all these exomes every day and knowing that that was not something that was available for most patients in Mexico. So that and, of course, many other factors came into play, but that was part of the decision. And yeah, I've been here in Mexico since 2021, sort of setting up the lab and training students and teaching and all of that good academic stuff.
So thinking back over your career so far, are there any decisions that if you had to, looking in hindsight, go back to, you would do differently? Alternatively, was there an opportunity that popped up that turned out to be exactly what you needed at exactly the right time?
Personally, one of the decisions I regret the most is where I went to do my postdoc. That was definitely a decision that changed my career path in many ways, and that in some ways, if I could do differently, I would. But at the same time, it sort of led to another career path that where I learned a lot, and I also met my husband and other lives happened as part of that. So, you know, it's definitely an episode that I don't remember fondly, but it also sort of had its positive consequences down the line. So,
talking a little bit about your research interests, would you tell us a little of the background for HapMap3? How you've helped contribute to it and why you think that project's important to genetics research in general?
Well, HapMap3 was very early on. So it was during my first year as a graduate student. It was at Baylor and the Human Genome Sequencing Center was one of the centers involved in HapMap3. So that was very exciting because the phase three of HapMap was when I think more of the rare variant spectrum diversity was started to be appreciated. So for the first two phases of HapMap, as we know, it was mostly focused on common variants and genotyping in major populations. So HapMap3 had many more populations and it started to do some sequencing at that time with next generation sequencing. So we started to see more of the rare spectrum of variation in world populations that I think nowadays, right, we recognize that it's so vast and that we need to do better in characterizing that variation across populations. In that sense, I think it was a significant study in that appreciation of variation in different populations.
This season, we're talking to people that are successfully involved in science in whatever way they happen to do so, either doing research or helping to guide research, working with communities, but who also have interests in making the scientific enterprise more diverse and equitable and inclusive, and also having the benefits of scientific discoveries work for everybody. What do those principles mean for you?
Everything. I mean, from the perspective of inclusion, right, of the workforce, I think having more people being involved, more diverse people with diverse backgrounds, with diverse education and also points of view, it's really important when doing research. So from the perspective that, I mean, I come from a genomic sciences program in Mexico. I know a lot of my classmates and people that have graduated from my program. We are there in many places around the world, but we need more of that representation. And also in teaching now, now as a professor in the program, sort of being able to make connections that give my students, the students of the program, more opportunities to have a seat at the table in the large genomics projects and in major institutions. And also, not just abroad, right, but also having that participation and that involvement from Mexico, right, that Mexican scientists can play at the same level as international level with major consortia, with other institutions, right? Like the Broad, like the Sanger Institute, like any of the major institutions doing human genetics and genomics research. I think it's important, and I want to help that to happen. And just in general, the part of access, it's a very important topic to me. Again, most patients in Latin America and in other low and middle income countries that have a genetic disease, they have no access to molecular diagnostics, not whole genome sequencing. We're talking about like array CGH or panel testing or exome sequencing. So while in other countries, we're starting to see programs for genomic newborn screening, in Latin America, like we are years away from that. I mean, most physicians won't ask for an exome because it's just too expensive. It's not covered by the healthcare system, so most families would have to pay that out of pocket, and that's very expensive. There's very little sequencing, especially clinically, happening in Mexico because the cost for us to sequence is like 3 to 5 times more than it is to sequence, to send the samples out, to sequence in the US or in Europe. But if we send those samples out, then we also lose that information, that genomic information that would be useful for creating databases for frequencies and variants in the population doesn't come back. So we're losing that information too. And also the capacity building, both on the infrastructure side and the human resources side. So if we send everything out, then like the people that are training here to be able to do this analysis, then where do they work? Where do they do research? Like, right? So all of those aspects, I feel very strongly about how to enable sustainable and equitable genomic sequencing in regions and countries where we don't have that yet. So, and I think it's in some ways a moral responsibility of us as genomics researchers that we have the technology to be able to sequence every patient with a genetic disorder. And yet we don't, because these people don't have access because they were born in not a high income country. So I think we need to do better and be able to enable that access to genomic sequencing, because we know it will change lives, right? From the management, they just even giving an answer to the family, why does this kid have a disease? But like access to therapies, that now we see so much progress in genome editing and other molecular therapies for rare diseases. But if they don't have a molecular diagnosis, they will never have access to something like that. So I think we do have a responsibility to do better in improving access to genomic technologies for patients.
In the last couple of years, you have sort of changed gears and moved from industry now to doing research, mentoring, and training on your own. So what has it been like to help support STEM education and maybe undergraduates or other early career scientists, trainees? How has that been since you've gone back to doing research?
I kind of never completely gave that up. I did miss sort of a more structure, like like giving a course. So nowadays, and actually this semester, I teach human genomics in health and disease. That's the name of the course. But even at the company I worked at, I used to organize these summer seminar series for like the internship students that would come over the summer. There's an internship program there, so we had from high school students to graduate students coming to do internships, and I would organize that and give seminars and ask other people to come and give seminars. Because I thought it was relevant for these students not to just be there for their project, but like learn more about everything else that was happening around them. And I had been also involved with the Skype a Scientist and other activities of outreach and education with ASHE, the DNA Day essay contest, and other activities. So I never completely left it, but I did miss a bit more of that interaction with students. I mean, it's really inspiring, right? Always to see the new generations and see many times the awe, right, in their faces when they understand something that maybe for us it would be in this field for some time. It's just obvious, right? Like, for example, when I show them like, oh, this is how a de novo mutation looks in next-gen sequencing, right? And you see the reads that are calling the de novo variant and you don't see anything in the parents, and then they light up and it's like, oh, wow, right? And like for us, it's just like, yeah, it's every day, right? Like I check like 50 of these a day, but for them, this is the first time they see and it kind of clicks. So that interaction, that naivete, right? Especially at the undergraduate level where they are discovering a lot of these concepts. And I do try also to emphasize to them that a lot of the conversations that we have in the classroom are happening in the bigger scientific sphere, right? It's not just like patronizing, let's talk about like the stuff that it's already settled and learned from the book. It's also like, let's talk about diversity and the importance of representation of other populations and like the pangenome, like how are we going to analyze that and things like that. So it's very gratifying for me to teach. I like it a lot.
Well, you've got to wear a lot of hats to do your job, the teacher and the scientist, but you also have to deal with your own day-to-day life and your family and your community and your personal interests, and all that stuff demands your attention every day in a tug of war. So what kind of support systems do you have in place for yourself, and what sorts of people and mentors have helped you along the way?
Mentorship is extremely important, and I also emphasize that to students, especially as some of them are graduating and looking into PhD programs and that. So it's so important, and I experienced both in bad mentorship, and I had my experience as a postdoc and learned what not to do. But also, I mean, Jim Lopsky, who was my mentor as a PhD student, has been great. I've also had other mentors, Richard Gibbs from the Genome Center at Baylor and Dr. Palacios here at UNAM. So they have been people that have really supported me and believed in me over the course of my career. And then personally, I mean, my partner, he's been extremely supportive. He's American, and just even from the part of like, okay, so what about we go back to Mexico to do research, right? So making that decision of changing country and living in a different country with a different language, it's a big deal. That many times for many of us that go to the U.S., it's sort of like this, that's what you have to do, but there are not a lot of examples of the reverse. So I think that he's open to exploring that decision and that option of coming to Mexico. I'm really grateful for. And then we do have a small child, a 3-year-old, which has a lot of energy. So he's also very supportive in sort of sharing that load of the childcare, which I think it's really important, because I mean, we often see, right, in conferences and that when the investigators come up and receive the awards, the recognitions, and many of them are like males that have like a wife, a supporting wife that has taken care of the kids and all the time that they've developed their career. So, I mean, in this case, he's not a stay-at-home dad, but we share a lot of the load, right? So, and that's helpful because if I need to go to a conference, he's the one that stays with the kid, and then we can share that responsibility. And then also the LIG, the International Laboratory for Human Genome Research, which is the institute where I'm in at UNAM, it's a very supportive environment. So we are a lot of young investigators, similar stages in our lives and careers. So many of us have little kids. So there's an understanding, right, of, well, maybe sometimes I cannot be in person in this meeting because I have to be at home with the sick kid. So I'm going to join by Zoom or be flexible in the hours, right, if you need to go pick up your kid or things like that. So we all work a lot, but there's also this community, this understanding of where we all are in our lives, in our careers, and there's that support as well. So
historically, genetics and genomics research, you had already touched on, has been very colonial, where most of the people included in studies were mostly white. Most of the people who were sequenced in the beginning were white and mostly male. And that there's this long history of wanting to understand the variation in other communities, but just sort of taking that information and then leaving. And then the positive outcomes of whatever they've learned don't come back to the communities that have actually contributed to it. So part of what you've worked on since you have gone back to Mexico is working on bringing newborn screening to Latin America. What kinds of barriers exist to implementing newborn screening in a way that's more accessible to everybody?
So the newborn screening ideas are a bit more recent. And part of the rationale is, like, we've spent almost 20 years trying to catch up with expanded newborn screening. So expanded newborn screening is just available in two countries in Latin America, Uruguay and Costa Rica. Most of the other countries in Latin America screen for 2 to 6 conditions, and they are not using tandem mass spec. And of course, we know the value of a very early diagnosis for rare diseases. So now, right after we've seen in the last few years all these pilots and all this data coming out from these pilot studies on genomic newborn screening and being a genomics scientist, so I would love to see a genomic newborn screening pilot done in Latin America. I think one of the major issues that we have for implementing genomics for clinical diagnostics in the region and Mexico is that there's this perception that this is technology that it's foreign, that it's happening somewhere else. We've had some legislators tell us, like, this is space science. Right, this is not something that happens in these countries, in these economies, in these healthcare systems. So one of the things that I've been working in the last year and a half or so is trying to advocate for, or trying to gather more so support to run a pilot program for clinical diagnostics, genomic diagnostics for rare diseases, and more recently for a pilot on genomic newborn screening. I think if we are able to demonstrate cost effectiveness, value, savings to the healthcare system, which especially in these countries that have socialized healthcare systems, right? If you go to the politicians and say, like, yo, you're going to save a lot of money in the healthcare system through doing this, I think that would be a very important flag, like, oh, maybe I should pay attention to this. So I do think that we need to demonstrate value in these countries, in these economies, in the healthcare systems that we have, so that they are more open to investing, right? Because ultimately it's an investment in the infrastructure, in the systems that would facilitate these type of national programs for genomic newborn screening or molecular diagnostics for rare diseases. So what I'm trying to gather support for is this pilot, so that we can demonstrate that, have a proof of concept that this works and how much is saved in terms of lives, in terms of healthcare costs, in terms of pain, right? Pain for the families that go through these years of diagnostic odyssey without ever finding what's the cause of the disease. Again, this is all very preliminary. We're working on it, both legislation. We have a group at the moment that we're working on revisiting a lot of the legislation and regulation for genetics and genomics in Mexico, but also on the implementation, so the technology part and how we would do that. Like, there are already places. So I was in San Diego a couple of weeks ago at the AGVT, and like Begin NGS, which is the newborn screening program for rabies, they are using data from Mexicans to train their algorithm for interpretation of newborn genomic screening variants and UK Biobank. And we have access to those data. And I mean, it's great that there will be a lot of newborns benefited from these data in California, but shouldn't we aspire to have that too? So that's kind of what we're trying to advocate for, like jump into the genomic newborn screening train now and not wait for it to pass like the expanded newborn screening train passed us already.
Do you have any advice for other scientists, maybe scientists who are outside Mexico and Latin America, for how they can help make sure that their discoveries actually can help have an impact for people in a broader reach than just a couple of people in high-income countries who happen to have early access to it?
So I think especially if you're in low- and middle-income countries, I think the major impact can come not from like having a publication in Nature or Nature Genetics or a high-impact journal, but more with directly reaching to the communities. I think the community engagement part is something that it's many times overseen, and it can be very important both for building trust, but also because especially with genetic data, like people in the communities will be the ones that will actually benefit directly from this data. So I would advise that people, I mean, it might not seem as glamorous, right, as maybe having a big Nature paper, but I think the personal and also professional accomplishment of going to the communities or talking to patients directly, to families, and returning those results and telling them what we have learned from analyzing the genetic data and what that means to them. And if in some cases, if that helps prevent some diseases or screen for certain diseases, that's a huge plus. But even just telling them, like giving that information back is very valuable.
Well, Claudia, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you for the invitation, and I look forward to hearing the episodes of the season.
Absolutely. This was Eli Robertson. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week for another episode.